Welcome to Violence and Verdict. From criminal act to conviction or acquittal, this podcast covers the details of some of the most interesting crimes.
Not only the gruesome details of what happened, but also what interesting legal details came up in court after the fact.
I'm your co-host, Taylor.
And I'm McKenna.
How you doing today?
Good. How about you?
Pretty good. Lots of drama. Yeah. In my friend's life, so not in mine, but I'm living, you know, vicariously through her. I'll have to tell you all about it sometime. But, okay. But I'm doing well.
Okay.
And you said you had a good day.
Yeah, I mean, I worked, hung out with my baby. I went to the grocery store, you know, got some bananas because he eats those like crazy.
He does.
Yeah, that's about the extent of... That was my day. That was it.
Well, at work today, I was talking with a coworker who listens to the podcast, and she was like, "Your sister-in-law, she always picks like the most disturbing, morbid stories."
I know.
And I was like, "I swear, she's not like a psycho."
Crazy. Like, yeah, I promise.
But she's also into like morbid stuff too. So that was kind of. She understands, okay. She was kind of laughing about it. The other thing is I was listening to our last episode and the best thing ever was the amount of times that I said in the last episode compared to the first one is probably like a quarter.
I know.
A lot, but the first episode, my goodness.
Well, I feel like we're just getting a little bit better at everything in general. Like even our storytelling and then like the little things like and the... kind of things.
Oh yeah,
there's better.
Well, I'm gonna laugh if someone doesn't agree. They're like, your first stuff was better.
I know. Well, you know, we're trying. Trial and error, guys.
Oh gosh. Well, I'm excited for today. We took a little break from recording, so it's been a little too long. It's been a couple weeks.
Busy few weeks. Yeah,
it has. So, flipped a coin. You won.
Yeah.
So you get to go first. Tell me your story.
Okay, so we're going to do, this one is a little more well-known, I think, at least in the true crime community, at least, if you're like into that kind of stuff, which I hope you are because you're listening, so, you know. But anyway, this is Mark Lundy.
I'm apparently not in this community because.
Well, I might just be deeper in it than you, who knows. Mm. But Mark Lundy, he was born in 1956 in New Zealand. He married Christine Lundy. I don't actually know her maiden name. Whoops. And they had one daughter named Amber. They jointly owned a kitchen sink business that was moderately successful. It wasn't huge, but like they were doing all right, you know? And he was a salesman for that.
So they owned it together and he did the sales.
Right. She was more like back office manager, kind of like...
Sounds about right.
Yeah, you know. here we go. So when Mark was 43 and they had been married for 18 years, it was 2000, a year before in 1999, they had bought a vineyard. I mean, they still owed some money on that. But from the outside and from what Mark claimed, like they were just a nice, big, happy family. Well, small family, I guess.
Big. All three of them.
Yep, the big ones. So we'll get to the crime. On Tuesday, August 29th of the year 2000, Mark was away on business in Wellington. So again, this is in New Zealand. The family lives in Palmerton North. That's like the name of their city, town, whatever. And Mark was away on a business trip in Wellington. It was about a 3-hour drive away. And they do their normal thing. Christine calls him to tell them that her and Amber are going to McDonald's for dinner. And that call ends at 5:43 p.m. Later that evening, Christine makes a phone call and talks to a friend at 7 p.m. A little while later at 7:20 p.m., there is a witness outside of the Lundy home saying a suspicious-looking jogger passed by. And then at 8:28 p.m., Mark, who's away on business, makes a business call and just does business stuff, I guess.
From where he is?
Yeah.
Because that's 3 hours later and he's 3 hours away.
Yeah. So he's in Wellington, both of the phone calls.
Okay. So he didn't actually go home in the 8:28. 3 hours. Okay.
And then a little while later, the Lundy home computer was manually shut off at 10:52 p.m. And then at 11:30 p.m., Mark Lundy calls an escort service and has a $140 prostitute come to spend time with him.
Trash. Not the prostitute.
No.
Mark. I mean him.
Yeah.
Married man. That's freaking terrible.
I know. So all this goes down, everyone goes to sleep, cool. Well, Mark the next morning tries to call his family, because again, that's what they normally do. He wants to call his wife, see how the night was.
When we know how his night was, so
yeah. When Christine doesn't answer multiple times, he tries every way to get a hold of her and can't, so he calls her sister, or Mark calls Christine's brother James. And he asks him to drop by the house and see what's going on. So James goes over and he goes through a sliding glass door and he is calling out their names, Christine, Amber, no one's answering. He goes around the house and he goes to go into Christine and Mark's bedroom and he sees Amber dead in the doorway. Aww. And there's blood everywhere. She is face down on the carpet. He freaks out, obviously, and he goes and he calls for help. He comes back into the house because at this point he hadn't seen Christine yet. So he just saw Amber, the little girl. And he goes back inside, finds Christine naked in her bed, also bloody and just beaten so badly. And later it was determined that they had been beaten to death by a tomahawk or axe-like weapon.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and the scene was very, very bloody. There was splatter everywhere. It was everywhere. It was very hard to see, even for like experienced investigators.
Well, New Zealand is usually so peaceful.
Yeah. I don't know. There's a lot of serial killers.
Oh,
there.
Really? Yeah. I didn't know that.
I don't know. They have a couple weird ones.
I know they kill a lot of sheep.
Catherine Knight is from there.
Oh.
Have you heard of her?
I think so.
She's freaking crazy. Anyway, we'll do her at a different time.
Okay.
But yeah, so at this point, obviously, they start investigating what happened. At the time, the pathologist, he determined that the time of death was between 6:45 p.m. and 7:20 p.m.
What?
Which is very specific, right?
That is very specific. Didn't she have a phone call at like 7:20?
At 7.
Ah!
So, yeah. So, we'll get into that. No weapon was found on the scene, and it's never been found. There was a back window that had been tampered with and had some of Christine's blood on it. And it was later found that a jewelry box was missing. And it was confirmed that Christine and Amber did get McDonald's for dinner, because there was a McDonald's receipt found at the home. And so at this point, no one, I mean, it's crazy town, right? And they start investigating for 6 months and then they arrest Mark Lundy and charge him with their murders.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
I'm just spoiling. This is my guess. He just gets the prostitute just for an alibi. Anyway, go tell me.
Okay. That's your guess. We'll see. So I'm just going to go ahead and I'm going to present the prosecution's case first.
Okay, cool.
So here's where it gets very interesting. 4 days before the murders, Christine and Mark had raised the amount on their life insurance policies.
Ooh, not a good sign.
I know. So hers was originally $200,000 and they raised it to $500,000. And unfortunate, well, I don't know if it's unfortunate, but the paperwork hadn't been fully processed. And so the change wasn't valid when she actually died. So even if he wasn't charged with murder, he would still only get $200,000. And the thing was this, you remember that vineyard that they bought in 1999, a year before?
Yeah.
Guess how much money they still owed on it?
$500,000?
$2 million.
Oh,
but,
oh.
Yeah. But I mean, like, obviously, he's but in they some owed serious a lot financial of money. Trouble. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Gosh.
And apparently he was keeping this from Christine. And so she...
The debt? Like...
Well, so it's kind of...
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So I think... So she was aware of like $48,000 for the...
So she didn't know exactly how much.
Yeah, she knew they were still in debt for the vineyard, oh, but gosh. I think he underestimated or he, yeah, whatever.
Downplayed.
Yeah. There we go. So that's a little crazy. And then there were paint, there was paint found in both the victim's hair, and it was the same paint that Mark used to mark his tools, like as his own, you know? And it was like the same paint found in his garage and on his tools. And that same paint was found in their hair.
Yeah. So that's weird.
Yeah. So it's like, was it one of his tools?
One of his tools for sure.
Yeah. Right. And then they also found Christine's tissue. Some of her tissue found on one of his polo shirts in the back of his car.
Like her body tissue?
Yeah. Just like.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Ew.
I'll get into that a little bit more because that becomes a huge thing.
In the back of his car.
Yes.
Well, it's him, right?
Well, yeah. And so they claim that that after the 5:43 phone call him and Christine had, that he drove super fast back home, killed his wife and daughter. And they claim that he wanted to kill his wife for the life insurance money and that Amber was a witness. And that's why he killed her. And... then he quickly did that, changed clothes, and then went back and got the prostitute.
For an alibi.
Right.
Well, we assume.
Well, yeah.
Or just because he's hopped up on murder.
They don't say that, but yeah. And so that's like their main evidence. Well, the defense, they here we go. They say, and like the testing does confirm that there was no splatter or like any tissue, no blood, no nothing on anywhere in or outside of his car, his glasses, his wedding ring, his shoes, and all other clothes. Nothing was found on them. Nothing. Even though the scene, if you remember, was like crazy and there was blood everywhere.
But... I mean, you could still use a different car and not wear your wedding ring or your shoes and stash your one shirt like an idiot.
Right.
Like, so why else would you have body tissue on a shirt?
Yeah. And so the thing is, I will say about the car, they did confirm that it was him just based on like the miles traveled and like
that he went
the
home?
Amount of petrol or whatever. But know that like the other car had not been used.
So his car had not been used.
No.
So it probably, if he did it, it was for sure a different car that he used.
No. That was the only car. The car that he was driving was the only one driven that night and used for whatever.
And it could have been driven to the house?
Could have been.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that is odd then. That's kind of weird.
It is weird. And then when... For the time of death.
Just so everyone knows, when she laughs like that, it's bad.
Yeah, I know. I'm so uncomfortable. I don't know how to handle it. So there are four methods to determine time of death. I'll go ahead and list them here. One is rigor mortis, which is like the stiffening of the body. Then lividity, which is the blood settling. Body and room temperature. And then eye potassium levels. And of those four things, the pathologist who determined time of death did not use any of them.
Well, what the hell did they use?
He used their stomach contents and smell.
Well, that's not...
Right. And
that
so,
seems awfully subjective.
Yeah. And so he claimed that their stomach contents were full. There was nothing in the small intestine yet. And so it had been... They had died about an hour after they had eaten, which based on the McDonald's receipt, they had eaten about 6 p.m. that night. Which,
well, so it's not like bad, but it's not official. Like, it's not the official way to determine.
Right. And then they also, so the defense, you know, they bring that into question. And then they also say that it's almost impossible to make that drive from Wellington to Palmerton North in the amount of time between his phone pinging in Wellington at both of those phone calls. So at 5:43 and 8:20 something or whatever.
So did they say impossible or
they said nearly? They said nearly.
Okay.
And they even had both sides, prosecution and defense, even had investigators and officers and other personnel like drive like this route multiple times. And in order to have, in order for Mark to have driven to his home, killed them and driven back, he would have to have driven the whole route in 68 minutes. And obviously, like, that has to account for time murdering and changing clothes, because again, nothing was found on his clothes or shoes, right? So he had to change. And then
this is puzzling.
It's very crazy. Yeah. And so he had to drive in 68 minutes. The closest that anyone would got was 72 minutes
without stopping to murder people.
Right.
Jeez.
And so, like, yeah, it's close, but also, like, he had to murder, and, like, it's just, it's crazy. Like, it's just, it's crazy.
Who had to sit on this jury? Oh my gosh.
I don't know. So at this point, like, who knows, right? His own brother made a public announcement saying that he thought Mark was guilty. And then Mark's sister and brother-in-law, they made a public announcement saying that they thought that he was innocent.
Did the one brother say why?
Just like based, they all say based on evidence and like circumstantial evidence.
Not based on like previous stuff they'd seen.
Right. And like, obviously, like, they were all surprised. They thought he was a good guy. Like, no one thought that he was just going to come out and murder his family. They also weren't aware of the financial trouble that they were in. But, you know, I mean, it's pretty split. Like, some people were convinced, others were not. The computer, if you remember, it was shut off manually at 10:52 p.m.
Yeah, so someone's in that house at that time.
Right, and at that point, Christina and Amber are dead.
Right.
Like, the time of death is correct.
Right.
But at that point, Mark is already back in Wellington.
It's so creepy. Uh-huh. I don't even want to sit in this house. It's like night right now, and I don't even want to be here.
I know. So there's that. And then some experts said that there was no evidence of any tampering to have the computer turn off. So, like, the prosecution claimed that Mark had been, like, moving files and, like, doing stuff to, like, trick the computer. I don't know computer technology stuff, but basically he like set it so it would turn off at 10:52 or like later in the night to make it look like that someone else had done it, if that makes sense.
No, yeah, so they say he's trying to give another alibi for himself.
Yeah,
that like it does it when he's not there to make it look like someone had to have been there when he couldn't be.
But experts, some say that there was no tampering, some say that there could have been, and like some claimed that like Mark wasn't that tech savvy enough to do that. So imagine, again, it's just like this
imagine
whole,
that defense. You're too stupid for that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how to
innocent.
Do that to you. So at this point, the trial lasted about 6 weeks. Over 130 witnesses were called, and the jury deliberated for 7 hours. And
that's shorter than I expected.
I know, it's pretty short, right? For such a like
crazy, a complicated, yeah.
Yeah. They came back and found Mark Lundy guilty.
You're kidding me.
No.
Oh.
They found him. Well, no, I'm not kidding. He was found guilty on March
21st, 2002.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And he was sentenced to life in prison with a minimum non-parole period of 17 years.
For both murders, I'm guessing.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Jeez. I didn't really see that coming, to be honest.
I know, right? And so obviously appeals are filed. An unsuccessful appeal resulted in his 17-year minimum getting raised to a 20-year minimum period of no parole.
Which lawyer pissed that person off.
Right? I'm like, they disagreed so much that they raised it. Like, well,
don't talk to us again.
I know.
Three
right?
more years. Goodness.
So at this point, obviously, his lawyers are still trying to file more appeals. During this time, a witness came forward saying that he saw Mark Lundy sitting on the foreshore of his motel in Wellington, reading a book just after dusk. When, according to like weather and all that, you know, he was supposed to be in Palmerston murdering his family.
So someone after this famous case comes yeah. out, after he's been in jail, says, oh, just so you know, now I saw him.
Right. And it was deemed to be semi-credible because they obviously used it. And on October 4th, 2013, the Privy Council upheld one of Lundy's appeals and he was granted a retrial.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So just based on like the evidence and like, it was all like circumstantial, whatever. He gets
someone was in a better mood that day.
Yeah. And so he was actually released from prison during this time.
Oh
and so he
gosh.
Was just like living at home.
Oh my gosh. That same house?
No.
Okay.
He
I
was living with
say,
family.
It's kind of morbid.
Yeah. And like at this time, like if you asked him, he was pretty confident that he would get acquitted because he is like claimed his innocence since day one. Like, he said he loved his family, like his wife was everything, his daughter, like it was their only daughter they were able to have. They tried for more, they couldn't. Like,
well, did he seem sad like about the murders?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, he was super sad, super distraught. In fact, he was kind of known as like an idiot. Like, he just like, it almost looked fake. It was like so much. And he was kind of like this big guy and he would just like shake and like be so loud and like it was just like a very big dramatic scene. Which, so you can,
who's to say,
it goes both
right?
ways, you
yeah.
know. So his second trial begins in 2015. So from 2013 in October to his trial, he's a free man, right? Well, the prosecution in this new trial claims that instead of them dying at 7 whatever, that he actually drove home after the prostitute and killed them at 3 a.m.
Oh. Well, that's a lot more credible.
Plausible.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that would make the time of death about 3. And the same pathologist who determined time of death before said, yeah, that could be possible. And another pathologist said, yeah, like we actually have no idea to prove which time of death is correct because none of those like lividity or rigor mortis were ever done.
Ugh.
So it's the stomach contents and experts disagree very widely on that, and like you can't determine time of death, especially within a half an hour, just based on that.
Right. I mean my metabolism is very different from yours.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense, you know.
Yeah. And so it's just like, who knows, you know.
Gosh, I wish that this is going to drive me crazy because I have a feeling that there's not going to be a real conclusion. And that's going to drive me crazy that this pathologist could have just...
I know, idiot.
Oh, come on, man. Just follow protocol.
I know. Well, that's like the hard thing about this case is because I feel like there's so many things that are like literally split both ways. And again, one of the prosecution's main evidence was that tissue of Christine's found in his
right,
car
that's
on
still,
the polo shirt.
That's still super weird. Why else would you have body tissue anywhere
well,
besides on your body?
Well, here. So, oh my gosh, this is absolutely insane. So the way that it was determined to be Christine's tissue was through immunostaining. It was a type of RNA testing that was most commonly used to diagnose certain types of cancers. The FDA described it as being subjective and variable. The lead investigator on the case, he literally had to search all over the world and ask like hundreds of labs and like doctors and stuff for someone to test the sample, and no one would. A lot of them said that even if they did try it and it like could work, the sample was so small and it was such like a not very advanced type of testing that it would be very difficult to get a definitive result.
So they didn't want like a guess pretty much
right.
to be on their conscience of someone
exactly
guilty or innocent.
Yeah.
being acquitted or convicted.
Yeah. Eventually, he found a man named Rodney Miller from a company called ProPath in Dallas, Texas.
The investigator found this guy?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so Rodney, he said, yeah, I can totally do this. Like, I'm like, he was super confident. After the test, like, he ended up testing it, and he said that it was positive for Christine Lundy's brain or spinal tissue.
Yeah, that doesn't just leave your body.
Yeah, so like, and like, that's what they said, like, oh, it could have been like a scratch or bump from an earlier time, but no. Guy is saying it's brain or spinal cord.
Yeah, that's bad. Yeah, that's a bad sign.
Yeah. But this type of testing,
I'm going back and forth.
It was the first time that this immunostaining testing, it was the first and the last time it had ever been used as evidence in a criminal trial. And it was the first time the test had ever been performed on a sample on fabric. I know. Yeah. So, yeah. And then there were other many other testing facilities around the world that discredited or cast serious doubt on the validity of the test and the positive result. Some other labs also said that based on the results, it could have been like the tissue could have been from an animal. And there was a meat pie found in close proximity to the shirt in his car.
Okay, meat pie is very different from brain and spinal cord tissue.
But again, like, this testing is like, I know, it hasn't been done. It's not like, it's absolutely insane.
I'm emotionally all over the place. I'm like, this guy did it.
I know.
But then it's like, but did he?
Yeah. And so again, this is the second trial. The jury deliberates for 16 hours, which I think is a little more fitting. And they find him guilty.
No. Oh my gosh.
Yep. They find him guilty again on April 1st. I'm like, what? April Fools? No.
Jeez. Well, so the weird thing is maybe he was innocent, because I feel like if you've been in jail that long and you're just given freedom, like, why, if you were guilty, why wouldn't you just skedaddle?
I mean, it would probably be hard at that point because you're still like under investigation. But yeah, you have a point.
But like, you know what I mean? Like, I would take, try. If I knew I was guilty, I would take the chance.
Yeah.
Because I mean, worst comes to worst, I'm found guilty again and I go back to jail anyway.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
I mean, so, yeah,
man,
who knows?
This is puzzling.
I know. And
so he's in jail still.
Right. In October 2018, his team filed another appeal. It was denied, even though it was ruled that the Crown ruled the evidence about the RNA, so the tissue sample on the shirt, was inadmissible, but decided the appeal should be dismissed on the basis that no substantial miscarriage of justice had actually occurred.
I don't know that I agree with that.
Yeah.
If you're saying something's not admissible, then something wrong happened. Yeah. And wow.
I know, right? Like, that doesn't make any sense.
I would be infuriated.
I know. And then on December 20th, 2019, the Supreme Court of New Zealand denied another appeal of his. So, like, the one appeal had gotten through, but the Supreme Court's like, nah, psych, deny.
Psych.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah. So the thing, it's insane. Like, this case was pretty famous in New Zealand. So at one point, there were different events planned. One was called the Lundy 500, and it was basically a bunch of people trying to make that drive.
Oh my gosh, that is terrible.
I know.
It's terrible.
Again, it was highly criticized by the media. It didn't end up happening. Same kind of thing happened. This one was called the Lundy 300 because it was about 300 kilometers ish.
It's a bit better named. Where'd the 500 come from?
I have no idea.
Okay.
But yeah, so that was happening. And those were like, one was in 2009, one was in 2015. Like, these were happening way later. Like, people are still like,
right.
Like, it's a still very active thing where people think he should be let go, where people think he's guilty. You know, it's just like,
gosh,
I feel like nobody really knows except for him. Some theories about it, because at this point, like, he's in prison.
Right.
He's officially guilty, but like,
twice.
Yeah, but I don't know. I don't know.
What do you think?
I think that there is a good chance that he is not guilty.
Yeah.
I think it's very possible that he could be, but just like all the mix-ups and like the validity of that tissue testing and like
it's enough to call into question.
Yeah. Like I don't think without like there is a doubt that he
Beyond reasonable doubt. I agree. That's what I think too. I think he still well could have done it, but I don't think he should have been convicted based on something that was not admitted.
Yeah, and I personally at this moment, so I've looked at this case multiple times throughout the years.
Uh-huh.
And I've gone back and forth, but today, right now in this moment, I'm feeling like no, he didn't do it. But ask me tomorrow, my opinion might be different. But like some people, like some family, friends, even just like strangers of organizations, some speculate that there was a creditor trying to get money from Lundy from the vineyard.
Plausible.
And that Lundy sent someone to his house to teach his wife a lesson, or that someone went over to like get money and things just got out of hand. You know, I mean, there's that whole thing. Some think it could have just been a random stranger acting violently. Others think it was a robbery gone wrong because there was that jewelry box missing.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's just, there's tons of theories out there. But his first parole hearing will be next year in 2022.
Ooh.
I know. So that'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Maybe we'll have to do an update.
Yeah.
When it happens.
Yeah. But that's a crazy case of Mark Lundy.
Wow.
I know.
Literally, I'm all over the place.
I know.
Good job.
It's crazy. I don't know what to think.
Good job. I like that one. And I actually, I don't know. Some parts of it sounded familiar, but I don't think I've really heard about the case.
Right.
So, okay. I'm going to tell you today about Ray and Faye Copeland.
Ray and Faye.
The oldest couple to ever be sentenced to death in the United States.
Whoa.
It's a really weird case. Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
Have you heard of it?
I don't think so. Let's get into
that. Makes me, if that's true, it makes me really proud because
I know
like everything.
Okay, yeah, go and I'll see if it sounds familiar.
All right, so Ray was born on December 30th, 1914, just after the start of World War One. Pretty bad time to be born because pops right into the Great Depression. He did get a younger brother and sister, and they became one of many victims of the Great Depression. And Ray had to drop out of school during the fourth grade in order to help his family maintain the farm
so
and stuff.
So
I know. Sad. I know. However, somehow he appeared to have been a spoiled child in the Great Depression.
Okay.
I don't know how that happens, but apparently he would demand things frequently and shortly they would be delivered to him. Upon demand. So at age 20, he committed his first crime. And what he did was he stole two hogs from someone.
Like
pigs. Yeah. Like in the farmland.
Like hog, pig.
Uh-huh. He stole two of them and then sold them in another town and like pocketed the money. His dad found out, but no like a formal charges were filed or anything. And because of that, Ray continued to commit more crimes in the following years, always the same in MO, stealing livestock and reselling them. But he did start turning to crimes, like more serious crimes. And he was arrested in 1936 for forging government checks in Arkansas.
Arkansas?
That's a weird state. Arkansas. Yeah. I don't know how anyone justifies that spelling.
It's stupid. English is stupid. I hate it.
Is that English?
I don't know.
Either way, in Arkansas, for which he was sentenced to a year in county jail for being caught forging those checks.
That's good.
So he's still pretty young when he gets out. And so upon being released from prison, he goes to a routine visit to a doctor's office, like a physician, and he meets then 19-year-old Faye Della Wilson.
Oh, so she's pretty young.
Wait, yeah.
What was her name?
Faye Della Wilson. Oh, yeah. Sounds like my daughter's name. That's funny. So Faye was born in 1921 to Rufus and Gladys Wilson. They were a really hard working couple from Harrison who had very little money. They somehow managed to raise 7 children in a dirt floor cabin.
Oh.
So like really rough.
And 7 kids? I see, that was my first thought, was like, whoa, that's a lot.
It's a lot for anyone yeah. in any circumstance, regardless of how much money you have. But yeah, can you imagine?
Wow. That's insane.
I know. I literally am trying to picture like trying to teach a baby to like crawl and walk and oh. the bugs and the... It was rough, but very loving family from what I understand.
Good.
So she, Faye and Ray start dating and in 6 months they're married officially.
Wow.
So really quick, within a year they had their first child named Everett, had another son 2 years later named Billy Ray. And in 1944, Ray decided to move everyone to Fresno County, California. And then they had a little girl named Betty Lou. Mm-hmm. 2 years later, they have a third son named Alvia and yet another son named William. So the same year that their baby was born, the last fifth child.
Mm-hmm.
So in that same year, Ray was accused of stealing horses from a local farmer, which
he probably did.
Probably he did because that's what he did.
Yeah.
There were no charges filed officially, but his reputation in Fresno County was completely damaged. And so then they had to move back to our Arkansas. less than a month after their relocation, Ray was arrested again for theft of cattle. So they've just moved back to Arkansas. They sit down to eat pretty much and he goes in. So it was real quick. He was found guilty of grand larceny and sentenced to another year in jail. So Faye gets left with 5 little kids while he goes to jail for a year. He does complete his sentence and then he moves his family to Missouri where he was arrested for cattle theft again.
Oh my gosh, dude.
Instead of going to prison though, this time he was sentenced to help with manual labor at a judge's farm.
Okay.
So a lot. Like he clearly has the same kind of thing that he does all the time and clearly these sentences are not enough to deter him from just doing it again wherever he goes. So just like his family, he kind of moves his family from town to town. So sorry, just like his family was growing up, he moved from town to town with Faye and the kids. He was arrested at least 5 times for writing forged checks. And during the summer of 1966, the Copeland family returned to Missouri where Ray and Faye successfully purchased their own small farm of 40 acres of land in Mooresville.
Okay, cool.
So they have their own farm. Faye takes a job at a local glove making company.
Sorry. Random.
I heard love making for a second. A local glove making company. So she works as a glove maker.
Huh?
Ray, he proved pretty unpopular with his neighbors who viewed him as a quote, bitter elderly man. And they suspected that he physically abused his family.
Aww.
Faye and the children later denied these allegations. But the owner of a local cafe described him as, quote, real bitey and snappy.
Oh, bitey.
Bitey and snappy. Sounds like
basically this guy
sounds like a toddler
sucks.
Named like an animal.
Bitey and snappy.
He added that Ray yelled at waitresses and intentionally ran over dogs. So he's just trash.
He's a terrible
right?
person.
So... Ray wanted to gain money. He knew another arrest would send him to prison for a longer amount of time. He formulated a scheme to scam people purchasing cattle and then getting away with it. So his plan was to show up at cattle auctions, catering hitchhikers and drifters. So he would find these people not Wanders. From the area that no one really knew. And he would have that man purchase a cattle, write out a check from Ray's book, sign the check, and then sell the cattle before the check could bounce.
Oh.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
And then he would claim innocence to the authorities who would eventually come to investigate and allege that the signatures on the checks on his checkbooks were forged.
Yeah, because someone else signed them.
Right, but he's saying that like
right.
he had no knowledge and someone's just trying to frame him pretty much.
I wish you could see my big eye roll right now.
I can.
Oh, everyone else.
Everyone else. since the men he purchased the cattle from were hitchhiker, or sorry, so since the hitchhikers and drifters had already skipped town due to their travels, it looked like they were liable to have forged, like, because they just skipped town right afterwards. Exactly. So it was pretty unoriginal scheme. I mean, but he was able to get away with it dozens of times until one of his scam victims, so one of these drifters, was picked up by the police.
Oh.
His name was Gerald Perkins. So he was a drifter. He had been participating, and the police picked him up. Yikes. And they interrogated him, and he exposed Ray's scheme.
Yeah. Good.
So Ray was soon arrested and sentenced to almost 2 years in jail for check forgery.
Dude.
Yeah.
Okay. At this point, like, he's obviously not going to stop.
He's a serial check forger.
Serial check forger.
So he serves his 2 years in prison. Poor Faye with all those kids by herself. Maybe if he did end up abusing them, maybe it was actually like a happy time.
That's true.
I don't know. But when he was released from prison, he decided to continue with his scam, but he tweaked it a little. So instead of having his scam victims write checks from his account, he would tell them to go to a post office box and open up an account in their own name this time. And then he would have them write checks from their accounts.
How did he convince these people to just do this?
He would pay them to do it.
Oh.
Yeah. So they were like...
I see.
Employed by him to do it. Yeah. Sorry. I didn't mention that. So they would open an account in their name. They would write checks from their accounts at the cattle auctions. And obviously, since they didn't have any money, they'd just open an account. They would bounce, right? His explanation for this to the scam victims, to these drifters, was that the auctioneers disliked him for one reason or another and wouldn't give him a fair shake. So they were like, oh, okay, I guess there's no harm, you know, I'll just make this money. So this time, though, because the last time he had been imprisoned was because one of those people had been caught and exposed him, he would eliminate the people, the witnesses, by murdering them afterwards. So this is what he started doing after that time.
Okay, but I feel like there's so much higher of a chance of you getting caught of murdering someone than like... And also the penalty is way worse for that.
Well, think about how old this guy is. Like...
What a dumbass.
He's gotten away with a lot of stuff. So Faye would eventually come to act as an accomplice in this scheme. That is kind of debated. I'll get into that in like the court case a little bit. Mm-hmm. But his scheme worked. So... they claimed 5 to 12 victims over that time.
Okay, that's a wide range.
Yeah, it is a wide range. There were five, and I'll get to this in a second. There were five actual bodies. Oh. There are more people that they believe have killed, but they could never find the bodies.
Gotcha.
So
that's sad.
Yeah. So at the time, so this is what's happening. He's employing these people, killing them after, and then moving on to the next. One such person was a 57-year-old named Jack McCormick. So he's a drifter.
McCormick. I love their spice packets. Sorry.
It's the same guy.
I bet
it's not. So he's agreed to help them, and he kind of catches on to the illegal side of it. He doesn't just believe that he's not getting a fair shake. Like, he's kind of catching
there's something off.
Yeah. So Ray sensed that McCormick was suspicious of him, and so he attempted to kill him. So in 1989, Jack McCormick called the Missouri authorities from Nebraska. So McCormick told the authorities that he thought he had seen human bones on the Copeland's farm.
Oh dear.
The authorities searched the farm, including using cadaver dogs like that can smell that, but they didn't find anything. So McCormick was taken into custody and questioned, and he recanted his statement about seeing the bones, but he did reveal something else.
Uh-oh.
So McCormick tells the police all about the check cashing scam that Ray had drafted him to do. He also told them that he was super afraid of Ray, like he just was afraid of him. And he recounted that one night Ray had asked him to come out to a neighbor's barn under the pretense of shooting a raccoon that had gotten into the barn. So Ray had his 22 bolt action Marlin rifle, and he and McCormick went to the barn, but McCormick felt off, wary of Ray, kept his eye on him. And when he went to poke a stick and get the raccoon out, as Ray had directed him to, he turned around and saw that Ray had that 22 pointed right at his head.
Yeah.
Somehow he says he tells police that he somehow talked Ray out of shooting him with the promise that he would leave town and never come back. He told Ray that before he left, he would make good on a hot check that he had written. So he's going to give Ray some money first. And he convinces Ray to take him to the bank where he could deposit his earnings and recover the money. Ray actually did this, and then McCormick slipped out of the back of the bank and ran over to a used car lot nearby, where he convinced the salesperson that he wanted to take one of the cars for a test drive.
Oh my gosh, and stole it.
While that test drive was his way out. So he...
smart.
Right. I mean, if you're going to get killed.
I know.
So... he waits until he's safely in Nebraska before he makes that call, the original call to the police. And because the police were already aware of Ray's arrest record and stuff, they gathered evidence to support his statements and secured a search warrant for the Copeland property. So after a week long search on the property, again, it's 40 acres, so it's really large. Mm-hmm. Three bodies, a list of farm helpers by Faye, and a quilt were discovered. And that will come into play later.
Okay.
The following week, investigators searched another barn purchased by Ray and found two more bodies. So Ray and Faye are both arrested at that time.
Okay.
Prosecutors quickly offered a deal to Faye. If she revealed to the investigators the locations of more bodies, her only charge would be conspiracy to commit murder, which would just be a few months of jail.
Wow.
However, Faye seemed to cover for her husband, telling the prosecutors that she was completely unaware of Ray's killings. And we'll get into that in her court case. But they were soon arraigned on 5 counts of first degree murder. And those murdered that were identified, those 5 people were Paul Jason Cowart, John W. Freeman, Jimmy Dale Harvey, Wayne Warner, and Dennis Murphy.
Sad.
And they had a bunch of ways that they identified them, which are pretty cool for the time. Like, you know, dental stuff. Yeah, like that.
Pretty advanced for
someone
the time.
Had a belt with his name on it. So that wasn't maybe as cool, but yes. So let's go to like Faye's trial first.
Yeah, because I'm like, did she know? Did she not? I haven't really heard a whole lot about her yet.
Yeah, I know. So all we know is that like she got married really young. She took care of a bunch of these kids when Ray was off in jail, yeah. And that some people think that he was beating her. Okay. Yeah. So on 1st of November 1990, Faye was 69 years old at the time, and she went on trial and claimed that Ray committed the murders without her knowledge and that she suffered from battered woman syndrome.
Is that a real thing?
It is a real thing. It is 100% a real thing. There was little doubt that Faye had indeed been a battered wife, so that was pretty evident that that was the case.
Yeah.
But for the jury, that was not enough to excuse her cold, murderous actions. So this is the evidence that was presented against her. So okay. The first one is Faye, as I said, she made a list of names of their farm workers. And these quote unquote farm workers were these drifters, oh, right? Okay. So she made a list in her handwriting of all the people that worked for them, which included the victims mm-hmm. that they had found. And at the end of the victims' names, there would be an X marking the fact that they had been killed. I mean, they argued that that X could be for anything. Or you know.
Like Ray could have done it, or I don't know.
Right. But it was for sure attributed to her hand.
The X was?
The X too. Was as well.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's pretty meh.
The more messed up and disturbing piece of evidence presented against her was that she had created a quilt made from clothing of the victims.
Oh my, what a dumbass.
Because of that evidence, she was found guilty of all 5 charges against her and was sentenced to death. Oh. Oldest woman in the States by lethal injection for 4 of the counts and then a life sentence without parole for the 5th.
Okay.
So Ray, trash that he is, so he heard that his wife of 50 years was going to get the needle and he quipped, well, those things happen to some, you know. So well, after he hears that his wife's going to be killed, executed. Yeah. And he apparently never asked about Faye again. He never asked about her ever again.
This man is awful.
The worst.
Ugh.
Yeah. So August 6th, 1999, though, so this is 9 years after that conviction, her death sentence was overturned because the evidence of her involvement wasn't enough to warrant a death sentence. And I would agree with that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
So she was still to remain in prison, though, for the still standing murder conviction. So she was going to be life in prison. There was an outrage of several women's rights activist groups who protested against the imprisonment and argued she was no longer deemed a threat to society. She was old. She was like in her 70s.
Yeah.
However, no one listened to these protests in December 2000 after an attempt to reinstate her death sentence a month prior. Tom and Jeanette Block, who are founders of Missourians Against State Killing, so they're against like death penalty, they continue to fight for Faye's release from prison by requesting that people send in letters to support her and to grant her release. But on August 10th, 2 years later in 2002, she suffered a stroke that left her partially paralyzed and incapable of speech. So she is kind of like an invalid at this point.
Yeah.
And as a result,
still in prison? Like
she was. She was when she got a stroke. But as a result of the stroke, she was paroled to Morningside Center Nursing Home in her hometown in Arkansas. Finally, December 30th, a year later after that stroke, she passed away at the age of 82.
Wow.
Ray's trial is a lot more straightforward. March 7th, 1991, so a year after her conviction, he was 76 years old at the time. He went to trial. He first tried to plead insanity, which... Right.
Yeah.
But he eventually gave up and tried to work out a plea agreement with the authorities. They were not willing at all to go along, and the first degree murder charges remained intact.
Good.
Yeah. So the main evidence brought against him was that authorities found a .22 caliber Marlin bolt action rifle against inside the Copeland home, which ballistic tests proved to be the same weapon as the ones used in the murders, and also matches obviously the testimony of Mr. McCormick, who said that that was the gun that was pointed at his head.
Mr. Spice Guy. Yeah.
poor guy. just
he's my favorite state guy blind. In the story. I mean, he kind of saved the day.
He kind of did. Yeah, it's true. So Ray is also found guilty of the charges against him, and he's also sentenced to death by lethal injection. However, 2 years later, he passed away while awaiting execution in the Potosi Correctional Facility. So he passed away at 78 years old.
Do we know what he passed away of or why?
Oh, yes. No, no. I don't know. I think it was probably something like a stroke or a heart attack.
He was old.
So while they're the oldest couple to be sentenced to death, neither of them died by execution, interestingly. But
well, I mean, those things take time. And like, there's so many appeals. Exactly. That are like,
and I think I agree with the appeals, like that they are.
Yeah, I don't think she should have been sentenced to death.
I know. It's really interesting. And there are a lot of opinions that like she actually didn't know, or she would have made a deal for herself that she like actually was unaware that she was making a list of what she thought was just farmhands. And that when Ray told her they'd moved on, she just crossed him out. They argue that the quilt was just material she found, and she was super thrifty from being raised in the Depression.
I don't know.
I know. It's all like,
I
possible,
think she's guilty of something. I don't know what degree of something that is.
I know. And how much...
I think she knew more than what she was letting on.
Yeah, I think that's likely. And it's complicated, though, because she was like a very badly abused wife. Yeah, and so that's kind of hard, too, is like... Years of psychological damage and fear can affect, you know.
Well, she was scared to like go again, like testify against him. Because I mean, his track record, he knows he could get released, you know?
Yep. Like, yeah, so I think it's possible she's possibly completely innocent. I don't know, but I'm glad that her death sentence was commuted.
Yeah.
Is that the right word?
Commute.
Erased, canceled. I'm going to assume her that's the right word. It felt right at the time.
Reverse? I don't know.
Yeah. I'm glad she didn't keep it.
Yeah.
And that's the story of the two oldest, some of the two oldest serial killers, but the two oldest death sentences in the United States.
That's crazy.
Ray and Faye Copeland.
And like, it was a lot. I feel like it sounded like it was so long ago, but it was like, what, 2002 that they died?
Yeah, it wasn't that long. Well, it sounded like it was a long time ago because it freaking started when they're old. Like, they're super
they're old people.
Like, he was still doing this in his 70s. That's the thing, is like, he actually was committing these murders as an old man.
When he was old.
Yeah. Like, and that's when he started doing it. That's kind of unusual too, right?
Yeah, like most people, like most serial killers
start early.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Way earlier than that.
Yeah. Fascinating, right?
Wow.
Yeah. This is a good one. This is a good day.
I like this one.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for listening, guys. If you haven't, and I know we're probably going to say this in a second, but when you go and rate us, like, we would love some comments, some thoughts. If you have feedback for us, we just want to improve, and we're having a really good time doing it.
I know, so. We're learning every time, so help us.
Yeah, help us out. We want more words. Yeah, we want more words rather than just like listens, but we're down to take the listens too. Yeah. So. Well, thanks so much, guys. Court is adjourned for this time, but we'll see you next time.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to Violence and Verdict. Make sure to hit subscribe so you don't miss out on any new episodes.
We'd also love it if you left a review so that more people can find and enjoy this podcast.
Also, connect with us on social media so we can freak out about these cases online together.